And with our trails report today, we've got Laura Smith from Mountain Trails Foundation. Good morning, Laura.
Morning, Leslie. Good morning, Park City. Today's trail report, we've got news that the 9,000-foot trail is just about done. It's not ready to ride, but like Devin said, we've got lots of rain coming, so that will help to tamp down the newly cut trail. And hopefully maybe sometime next week we'll be able to get out on a couple miles of that trail up high at about 9,000 feet. It's I don't know if Charlie's talked about it in prior reports, but starts kind of over at the top of Guardsman Pass and then heads towards Park City. So it's a pretty cool piece of trail out there. We're also doing some cutting out in the Bonanza Flat area. So all those new cut trails will benefit from this next round of rain this weekend. And then we've got, Tour de Suds, not this Sunday, but the next Sunday. It's kind of the 35th annual Tour de Suds, party on bikes, get out there, have fun. It's a locals event. That about wraps it up for what's going on in Park City for the next week.
Okay, Laura, hey, thank you.
Yeah, talk to you soon. Bye.
8:12 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. This is the KPCW Local News Hour. Well, joining me now on the phone, I have Summit County Planning, Zoning, and Design Director Peter Barnes to tell us about a number of ongoing development projects in Summit County. Good morning, Peter. Thanks for filling in for Pat Putt, who usually does the segment.
Good morning, Leslie. I always recognize the fact that I'm a very poor substitute for Pat, but I'll do my very best.
Okay. So let's talk, where are we with the NMU zone? That's the Neighborhood Mixed Use Zone.
I thought you were going to ask me something simple, like, you know, the solution to the United Kingdom leaving Europe.
We're going to get to that if I have a minute at the end.
And NMU in the process, for people who don't know what that is. A number of years ago, back in 2016, when we adopted the new general plan, staff had been working on essentially a new zoning proposal, a mixed-use zone. We currently don't have a true mixed-use zone. The closest we have to that is the community commercial zone, probably, which allows a variety of uses. The mixed-use zone is supposed to be something much more specific. It's supposed to be truly designed mixed-use zone. The purpose, you know, it's supposed to provide for more compact-type development, high densities, mixing more of a residential component with an employee-generating component, so you get a balance of live-work-type areas. It's supposed to be pedestrian-oriented, transit-oriented, and what we're trying to do is roll in some performance-based design criteria that goes with that. So the mixed-use zone itself is... We're currently designated it, the current proposal. It's been to the Planning Commission, I think it's four times now. We'll be going back to the Planning Commission for a work session next Tuesday. And then we'll be following that with more formal public hearings again. But the mixed-use zone is supposed to be applicable to certain areas where we have talked previously, for those who have been following, where we've talked about nodal development, the concentrated areas where we have existing commercial centers, where we have residences surrounding those higher transit routes, where we have transportation options. We've identified on the future land use maps in the general plan areas that we've looked at and considered as future uses for mixed-use areas. Those are identified in the general plan. Those are not currently zones. What we're trying to do is write the code language that goes with a new zone. We will not, through this process, be actually creating or rezoning another property. What will happen after we create the zone, those properties that are located within the areas identified in the general plan will become eligible to apply for this new zoning designation. It's a fairly complex process. We've been talking about it on and off for a number of years. What triggered this recent revival of it was an application, if you've heard, from a certain developer in town, Henry Sigg, who had a proposal for a large commercial area near Home Depot. It's like two sites, I believe. One's about 15 acres, one's about 5 acres, just across the road there, further towards the Promontory Road exit. He came in with an application under current CC zoning, and essentially he could achieve the bulk of what he was applying for under conditional use permit criteria. he was aware of the process that planning staff had been going through trying to create a genuine mixed-use zone. And we talked about how the process would be improved if it was truly mixed-use. So Henry Sieg himself, in order to revive a stalling process that was going on at staff level, actually put in a formal application to create this new zone. It does not rezone his property, as I said before. It doesn't rezone anybody else's property either. But it pushed us back to the table with the Planning Commission to go through the process, to negotiate and discuss the issues at hand. We've actually made a significant amount of progress. The last meeting we had, we were actually stuck on things like if we're going to allow increases to height in exchange for structured parking or affordable housing units, then how do we modify those controls so that the additional height doesn't become completely out of place in the location? It's not something that could be abused. So Ray Milner, our hardworking and witty, charming, devastatingly intelligent planner, has been actually cruising through these plans of late, churning out pieces of paper, coming up with alternatives and studies and variations on a theme about how we can address things like height, how we can address things like parking. And the one of the other criteria that the Planning Commission pointed out last time was how do we, or is it possible to roll the connectivity aspects, make a bigger statement in the zone of, like, say, the active transportation plan, for example, that Caroline Rodriguez is working on right now, our transportation director. Is it possible to actually directly input some of these alternative proposals into a zone? It's drawing the process out, but it's actually making it much more sophisticated and whole program, if you understand that.
And I guess what most people would care about is, you know, are we forsaken? Are we giving developers an opportunity now for more density? And why would we do that?
Quite possibly. In certain locations, yes. The one has to look at the philosophy of we are going to grow. The question that you have to grapple with is this a growth-inducing phenomena or is it a growth management strategy? And we definitely see it as the latter. If, for example, in the case of Henry Sieg's specific project, if he's proposing to introduce new commercial uses into that area, does it not make sense to balance it in an area where, you know, if we have a deficit of employee housing, affordable housing, a variety of housing types, would it not make sense to locate them in the same area? If you consider that the alternative to the people who do currently live there, maybe the Silver Creek Village development that's under construction right now, or the people at the Promontory, if their only option for service commercial uses, neighborhood commercial uses, is to drive into Kimball Junction, then that movement of people itself is creating a traffic problem. So if we can actually induce the growth that we know is going to occur in areas where it actually makes sense to concentrate it, in those areas where we actually have existing transportation options, existing communication with the local road network, and opportunities to develop transit, and the access to the trails that exist in those locations too. But mix the uses in a balanced way, so that people are not required to move around unnecessarily.
Yeah, but we already do have a growth management strategy in place, and that is already on the book saying that, you know what, we will not allow any increase in density and without some compelling reason. So, I mean, it just sounds like we kind of blew it with some of the development we already approved, like Promontory, by not requiring some of that service commercial. So it just sounds like now we're giving more density to make up for past mistakes.
I'm going to challenge that in the fact that if we know we're going to grow, think about. I use this example, Leslie. If you just look at the affordable housing, let's just accept for a minute that we have an affordable housing problem. Let's accept that we actually have reports that say we should be building up to 200 units a year for the foreseeable future, just to catch up on our deficit. Well, ignore what that total is for a minute. And just let's say we need 200 units of housing in the Snyderville Basin. Our current zone allowance under the existing density requirement of one unit per 20 acres would require a developer to assemble a parcel 4,000 acres to provide for that density. Clearly, that's ridiculous. We don't have 6.25 square miles of the Snyderville Basin to dedicate to 200 units of affordable housing. It makes sense to concentrate in certain pockets. It makes sense to create the nodal development in those locations where the transportation already exists, the opportunity to develop in an economic and sustainable way a true public transportation network where people have opportunities to, can we develop bus systems in those locations where people already are? If we take that need for development and the existing entitlements that are already out there and spread them across the basin, we would just be exacerbating a traffic problem.
All right, let's move on. I should mention, though, the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission has the NMU zone on their agenda for September 10th, this Tuesday. The public hearing, however, won't be held until their meeting September 24th.
That's the idea, yes, and we will be probably forwarding another notice to confirm the 24th public hearing.
All right. We've also talked to Pat about the Olympic View project. This is formerly known as the Boyer Tech Center. Again, another whole change in the way that, we saw this a few years ago, wanting to bring good jobs to the area. And now it sounds like we've just got another specially planned area with lots of commercial and residential units.
Well, it might sound like that to a lot of people, and I understand there's a reaction to that. That's why we're taking it in a fairly agnostic fashion right now. We're looking at it. There is an existing development agreement in place with an approval in place, unbuilt, 1.3 million square feet of commercial development. Part of that has obviously been built. We have the Skull Candy building. We have a couple of units there. There is an allowance right now under their existing development agreement to build, let's say, somewhere between another 15 and 20 Skull Candy-type buildings, 3,000 parking spaces, no residences. Every one of those people working in that project will be driving to and from that project. The new owners of the development are suggesting something more in line with what we just talked about, which is a mixed-use development. So can we vary the types of uses so that while we're going to grow and it's going to develop, then can we actually adjust the development pattern so that the types of use is actually supportive of each other, and rather than having people driving in and out of the project, that they're moving through the project. So I'm sorry, Liz, I'm getting some feedback here on my phone.
Okay, is that better?
Can you hear me? Yes, that's
yeah.
Good.
Okay.
So what they've done significantly, and is something that we're currently working on, Kirsten Whetstone, who actually recently joined us from Park City, has been combing through the details of this application, and this application will actually be introduced at a work session to the Planning Commission on the 24th. That we're actually analyzing the actual application. That they are asking for more square footage. They are asking for a significant number of residential units. I believe it's almost 1,000 multifamily apartment type units. And 100 townhomes. There is a lot of work being proposed here that involves trying to resolve the traffic issues, actually involves addressing the intersections of Ute Boulevard and 224, the current congestion we have. The strength in their proposal comes from their traffic analysis, which, again, we're just objectively looking at it right now, is that based on the original proposal in the development agreement, which is already approved, versus what they're proposing, their analysis today says that the peak hour traffic flow will be reduced because of the mix of uses within the development. Now, clearly, we're in a trust but verify mode, so we actually have to go through it with a fine-tooth comb, get the details beyond the application, the large square footage numbers, and actually break down into bite-sized pieces what's actually going to be involved here. As well as the houses, they are proposing civic uses, some transportation options. There's some very interesting proposal for, say, a gondola to connect this location up to the Olympic Park. They are not proposing to build that. They are proposing to partner in that. The question is, who are those partners going to be? It's the same with the transportation solutions on 224 and New Boulevard Olympic Parkway. Those transportation proposals actually involve complex relationships with a variety of entities. So whilst parts of this proposal might be able to stand on its own, as an entirety, this is a very complex but forward-looking project, and we're kind of excited to see it, but we're approaching it with the same degree of trepidation that many other people would, too.
Yeah, I'm about out of time, but I've got to just mention, that gondola project, really, is that just to try and entice another Olympic Games? Is that what that's all about? It's not like we've got that much traffic going up to the Olympic Park.
I'm not going to ascribe motives. When I look at the gondola up to the Olympic Park, I actually consider personally, I say, well, how interesting would it be if it could go across the other way too, so it could connect the east and west side of Kimball Junction? I think it has a lot more potential uses if you think of a variety of transportation options, and this is one. There are gondolas in places like Colombia. And in South America, they don't have an Olympics there, but they use cable cars to resolve their traffic problem. So there's many uses and many proposals. How realistic this is, we don't know, but we'll dig into those details, and it will be a question that I'm sure the Planning Commission will be very interested in.
Okay. I got to get to the next interview, though. I just want to make a mention that does go to the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission, September 24th. Also, the Cedar Crest Hoytsville Village Overlay going to Summit County Council on Wednesday for a progress update. Real quick, Boris Johnson doing a good job?
I'm going to keep all my political opinions to myself. that's all I'm going to say on that.
Okay. Hey, Peter, appreciate your time this morning.
No problem. Thank you.
Well, as many as 70 Park City and Summit County residents, including the members of Leadership Class 25, have spent the last couple of days traveling to Crested Butte, Colorado, as part of the annual road tour. Joining me will be Summit County Councilmember Glenn Wright and Councilmember Lynn Peake. First, a quick introduction from KPCW's Rick Bruff. Morning, Rick. So far, so good?
So far, so good. I'm here with Lynn Wernpeet and Glenn Wright, and we've had a busy day gathering information and also assuring passerbys that they're not new employees for Vail that have just come into town. So I'll hand you off to Lynn. Hang on just a sec.
Okay.
Good morning, Leslie.
Hi, Lynn. So real quick, what are your takeaways from Crested Butte?
Well, it's an absolutely gorgeous town defined by its geography, really. The hotel we're staying at in Mount Crested Butte is at 9,300 feet. And I guess the thing that really got me was when the bus rolled through town, there are dirt roads that come off Main Street. New construction built in town is built on dirt roads, not all dirt roads, but some. And that was just staggering to see. And really so beautiful. There are no stoplights in town, just four-way stop signs, which one leader here described as his favorite place in town because people are so polite and they wait for each other and they wave to each other. And I just thought that was a concept that, kind of eluded me, and it was delightful to hear about. Just another couple quick observations. I know we're running short on time. is the whole town is in the historic district. So if you're going to build in town, there's actually a maximum house size. So that would be 2,800 square feet as a maximum house size. Now they allow some exceptions for detached garages and also accessory units. So they're really big into incentivizing accessory units for affordable housing. And I sent you a few pictures. I don't know if you got them, but you can see them later if you didn't. So that's a big takeaway. Affordable housing focus, a really big takeaway. 24% of their units in town are deed restricted. So they really recognize that if, unless they supply affordable housing, they're just not going to have employees. That's kind of the bottom line.
Real quick, e-bikes, where do they stand on the issue of allowing e-bikes on dirt trails?
Well, that's definitely an issue. But, you know, one thing they have here, because there's so much public land, is motorized trails. So if you can ride a motorcycle on a trail, you can also ride an e-bike. That makes sense. What they do say about it, they have 450 miles of single-track trail, and they say they will not be able to handle it if e-bikes are allowed, as in, e-bikes, mountain bikes that are e-bikes. They won't be able to handle it. It's just too much. They already have a lot of people on their trails as it is, and even with that many miles, they feel like they just won't be able to handle it.
Okay. Well, I appreciate your time. I know you're getting on a bus, and I've got another interview. Would you pass the phone over to Glenn Wright?
Here he is.
Okay.
Thanks, Leslie.
Thank you, Lynn. Hi, Glenn.
Good morning, Leslie.
So you met with the Gunnison County Commissioners, and I guess they're dealing with issues very similar to what we see here in Summit County, energy, development, employee housing. Have they figured out any interesting and practical solutions?
They have some different solutions. I think we have the same issues. The main difference in how we address them is based upon geography. This is a very remote community. We're close to Salt Lake City. And the legal environment differences between Colorado and Utah. They do have more home rule abilities here that we don't have in Utah. For instance, with affordable housing and nightly rentals, they're allowed to tax nightly rentals and use that money for affordable housing. And that's not something we can do in Utah. The other main thing I saw that was different was our approach to environmental issues. We had the same goals in terms of trying to get to a zero carbon footprint, but different environment here. Ours actually is working out better for us because we cut this deal with Rocky Mountain Power to go to 100% renewable electrical energy. Their local utility doesn't want to hear that. They're a coal utility and they want to stay a coal utility. So what they've done with their internal resources, they've built an incredibly efficient new county courthouse. It's net zero ready, and they'll be putting solar panels on it in the near future. But they don't have the ability to get 100% renewable electrical energy into the community.
Okay. Any takeaways then, or you're bringing back to Summit County?
One interesting takeaway on affordable housing. They have a regional approach to affordable housing, and they have a regional housing authority that encompasses Gunnison, Gunnison County, Crested Butte, Mount Crested Butte, and a couple of smaller towns. And that's a clearing agency for all of their deed-restricted housing and rental housing. So I think that's they're taking a real regional approach throughout the county. And it's something I think we can consider doing. But with our situation and proximity to Wasatch County and Heber, I think it's worth having discussions with them on this issue.
Okay. Hey, Glenn, I appreciate your time. I know you're going to jump on the bus.
Very good. Thank you, Leslie.
Okay. Thank you. That's Summit County Council Member Glenn Wright. KPCW News Time now, 8:35. KPCW News Time now, 8:36. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, the Hideout Town Council met yesterday to discuss the future of their town, including plans to upgrade their internet and possibly become involved with the MIDA project. Joining us now, I have the mayor of Hideout, Phil Rubin. Good morning. Thanks
Good
for
morning.
Being here.
Good morning. Thanks.
So Hideout has been considering joining the MIDA project area for a while now. Can you talk to us a little bit about what the benefits for Hideout and your residents would be if you did that?
Okay, sure. So the MIDA project brings, the MIDA authority has been granted the opportunity to drive recreational development in the area. And they do that by appropriating a large portion of growth taxes and redistribute those back to residential areas or the project area, the people that join the project to use for those kinds of things. So Hideout is just... earlier this year, we redid our general plan. We have a vision for connecting the community, creating some green space. You know, when Hideout was built, it was imagined as basically exclusively residential. There's no public land inside of Hideout today, and we want to change that. You know, as the community's grown and we see the need to do that, and MIDA brings us an opportunity to do that because with their participation, we get a significantly larger portion of tax revenue than we would any other way. So without raising taxes for residents, you know, we get tax revenues that are taken by MIDA and redeployed back at a much higher rate for us to use to do those kind of developments. So we're excited about the opportunity of having a chance to bring some of that green space, bring those trails, bring some of that recreational stuff to the town without adding to the tax load for the residents.
Yeah, but basically, I mean, for the first several years, all that money that is collected through that project area tax increment, that's going to Extel and Wasatch County to build roads, chairlifts, hotels. When is Hideout in that list?
The Hideout area is managed independently from Extel and that kind of stuff. So, you know, the tax revenue that we generate through growth in the areas that would be part of the project is exclusively for Hideout use. So we don't see ourselves competing with Extel. What we're competing with is, you know, will the growth that's planned for those spaces happen at a rate that generates revenue back to the town?
So if the belief is that this MIDA project will be a success, why not then just benefit 100% from increased property taxes? That's because of the assessed valuation in the area rather than just the 25% that MIDA would dole out to Hideout.
Well, MIDA is actually doling out a larger portion than that. And the reason that we look at it this way is that we get, from the Hideout town standpoint, our tax portion, okay, if you look at your tax bill, we're 0.0008, okay? The county base is much higher, and so we get a much bigger chunk of that back than we would just sitting on our own. So staying out of MIDA versus being in MIDA, for us, turns out to be over 25 years, something on the order of $15 to $20 million.
Okay. Your council has had to look at some financials, and I haven't seen that report. I don't know if it's public at this point or not. But maybe you can just talk to us in very simple terms. If today, and again, I am just throwing out numbers. I don't know anything. But if Hideout collected $1 million in property taxes today, under MIDA, Hideout would only pull in $250,000, with the other $750,000 going to MIDA. So in order to continue to provide the services and the needs and the wants of Hideout residents, where does that $750,000 come from?
So if we take your example, okay, the county tax base is not $1 million. If the Hideout portion were $1 million, the county tax base is $10 million, $15 million, whatever it is, okay, the total tax bill. So your total tax bill has money for schools, it has money for special services districts, all those things. MIDA gets all of that. And so when they dole it back to us, okay, it ends up being a multiplier versus just our pure base tax base. And that's how our other folks in the because of this arrangement, our other districts, quote, disadvantaged, I guess, to some degree. They keep their current tax base. They grow 25% with the growth, but the balance of that is what MIDA is taking, not the 25%, but the 75%. And that comes back to the town at a much higher proportion than it would staying outside.
That sounds like fuzzy math to me. I mean, you're confident that this is the way it's going to work?
Yeah, we've attacked it nine ways from Sunday. We've had Zions Municipal Finance helping us with this analysis. And, you know, we've dissected the act. And, you know, it looks like it's going to be a nice thing for Hideout. I mean, as far as Hideout goes, what we're doing is we're paying thousands of dollars a year as a homeowner to the county of Wasatch. And what we get back from a Hideout town perspective, okay, is roughly, for the total residency of Hideout, I get roughly $100,000 a year, okay, out of our tax bills. That's what I get to run the town with. So with MIDA, I'm going to get significantly more than that. And that's you know, that's the exciting part to us.
Yeah. So this Zions analysis, is that a public document at this point?
Yeah, I'm sure we can find it on the website. It's it should be in the minutes of, you know, the meetings we've had.
Okay.
I haven't specifically checked for it, and if it's not, we'll get it there.
Okay. So can the money then from the hideout area collected for MIDA, can that be spent in any area or only on hideout then?
It can be spent in both the hideout zone, okay, the portion of hideout that would be in the MIDA project, and adjoining areas as long as it aligns with the mission of MIDA. So, for example, if we were to build a park and ride that wasn't in the hideout zone but was accessible to those that might want to use it that are in the MIDA project, that would be an acceptable use. If we were to put parks in, connections to trails that are outside of the hideout zone in the MIDA project but still available to the public, that would be an acceptable use. So we get a fair bit of flexibility on how we do that.
Yeah, so how are those projects defined? Who gets to decide what those are? Is that a MIDA decision?
It's in the hideout zone, it's a hideout decision. In adjoining areas, it's a joint decision between us and MIDA.
Okay, and there is some kind of board? Or, I mean, how... Because again, MIDA exists in Kaysville, Utah, you know.
Right. So there is a MIDA board for projects that need to go to the board for approval. But in general, from what we've seen, we've got a fair bit of flexibility as long as, again, we're aligned with their goals.
All right. So Hideout was scheduled, the council scheduled to hold a truth and taxation hearing in order to raise property taxes. Did you do that?
We did that. That happened last month, and we did raise the tax rate from 0004 to 0008.
Okay, and how much money is that going to raise?
About $50,000 a year.
Okay, and then what was that money needed for?
Primarily, we've been running the town municipal needs, so maintaining water, maintaining sewer, maintaining roads, snow plowing, all that kind of stuff, basically with revenues from permits and growth. That's unsustainable for the long term. You know, there's predictions in the economy is going to be a slowdown. We need to have a revenue source to keep our town running that's independent of, you know, building growth. So we had to bring that up.
Yeah. Let's see. And is that the last tax increase that you think you're going to need?
I don't know yet. I mean, it depends on what the citizens want as far as additional services. I mean, nothing comes free. So if we want more parks and more parks to be maintained and other amenities... You know, it's possible that we could be coming back to the well one more time.
Yeah. And kind of looking back, I mean, Hideout was one of those communities that back in, was it?
11 years ago now.
08, yeah, where, I mean, for a month or something, people, basically it was property owners, could come in, create their own municipality. I mean, it was just kind of bizarre. I mean, how it all came to be. And, you know, the lawmakers that allowed it must have known that there were property owners that could do this. Looking back, though, I mean, was that a good thing? Or would have been better off just as a development within Wasatch County?
Well, I can't say what would have been better for 10 years. I know what we inherited. And, you know, it's a town with people and people who care. We've got an active planning commission. We've got a new council that came in with at the same time that I was elected, that has a greater town representation, and we're taking what we've inherited and putting our arms around it and running it. So, you know, would we? I don't know. I don't know what Wasatch would have done with us or not. I can't begin to guess. But we're, you know, we're happy where we are. We have a beautiful location, and we want to make sure that we have a voice in how it grows.
Also, on yesterday's agenda was some kind of deal to get high-speed internet or fiber optic
right
into Hideout, and this is from Utopia. What happened with that?
So we've been approaching. We had an internet committee formed probably a year and a half ago. They've been working really hard. They've done a great job. out testing with a number of providers to see what they could bring to the community. And so they've talked, we've talked with Utah Broadband, who's our current provider, around what they can do to bring our speeds up. We met with All West, who's got fiber running along SR-248, but hadn't been into Hideout. Met with Utopia to see what they could bring to the table. That whole activity has spurred greater interest among the providers, which is great. I mean, that's what we were after, is getting high speed in there. So All West has come forward and aggressively started to service the town. So we're not turned on yet, but they're running cable as we speak. So that's exciting for us. And they've also come in with a rate decrease, which is also exciting for us. Utopia has also been very, very good with working with the town and giving us a proposal. The challenge with Utopia for the town was we were going to have to, the municipality was going to have to backstop the cost for their investment until we got to a certain level of participants or sign-ups for Utopia. So it wasn't a large number, and we were thinking very seriously about that. But with the activity of All West, it makes it a much tougher decision now. So that's we have extended the hearing so that the Internet Committee can do some more research and come back with a recommendation. So we'll see how it goes.
All right. So you say that you do have Internet and cable service through Utah Broadband? But it's just not at speeds that people are happy with.
Right, because it's line of sight. It's not wired service. So we're all looking at the tower sitting on top of Mayflower at Deer Valley. And you know, when it snows, it slows down and stuff like that. So,
yeah. So when do you expect a decision to be made?
I'm hoping they'll get it done this week. If not, certainly by our October meeting.
Okay. And then finally, where's Hideout with regard to the annexation policy plan?
Well, we passed the annexation policy plan last month. It was, we got a lot of great input from a lot of neighboring communities. We did a lot of revisions based on that input and have, we'll change the footprint somewhat, taken out the MIDA area, backed away from some Park City space that we were encroaching on. Let's call it a stake in the sand for the pieces of property that surround the Jordan L that are not in the MIDA project. Does that mean we'll annex them? I don't know. But as I talked about earlier, in furthering our goals of the general plan, where are we going to get public space? Since the space we have is privately held, how do I get public space? Well, through annexation is another potential. So if developers want to come in and say, landowners want to come in and say, hey, I want to build something here, but, I know you guys also have needs. Maybe we can pull something together. I can build you a park when I build, 25 houses here. Would you like that? Or those kinds of dialogues can take place. So that's what can come from it. We're not certainly going to just say yes to everything that comes across the table. If it's not furthering our goals, we're not going to do it.
So yeah. Are those parcels you're referring to near the Jordan Hill, are those in some unincorporated Summit County?
Some are in, most are in Wasatch. There's a few in Summit. The interest has been raised by landowners to us. Some of those landowners have parcels across all three boundaries. Okay, we have landowners that have land in Hideout and in Wasatch and in Summit, same parcel. So they're looking for a single land use authority to work with. So it provides potential for us to grow. We've attained the things we want to do. Now we've since prior to that meeting when we approved it, we did meet with Summit County and Park City. We had a great session. I think we found that we're a lot more aligned than misaligned together. I think Peter was on earlier. And he's saying a lot of the same things that I'm going to say. Our goal is to find a way to manage the fact that we are going to grow, and getting an environment that we want to look at and be part of as we grow. So that's there's no coup here, as has been potentially written up in some of the things. But we're not out to do that. We're simply saying we want a voice, And this is a chance for us to talk about how to do that. You know, would we love to see it stay green? Hey, come on in, Summit Land Conservancy. Come on, let's go do that. But barring that, how do we manage that growth holistically?
Okay. Anything else you'd like to mention, Phil?
No, it's an exciting time for Hideout.
Okay. Hey, appreciate your time this morning.
All right.
That's the mayor of Hideout, Phil Rubin. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. Newstime 8:53. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, the Christian Center of Park City once again hosting the Hike for Hunger. Organizers looking for folks to pre-register for the event. In the studio, I have Pete Stoughton, the center's director of programs and volunteers. Good morning, Pete.
Good morning.
Let's see. It's scheduled for Saturday, September 14th.
Yes.
And signups are taken even the day of?
Yes, we are signing people up today and through the week, as well as day of at Deer Valley.
Okay. So tell us, what happens on Hike for Hunger?
Well, Hike for Hunger is one of our biggest events where we really want to bring awareness to the community in the Wasatch back that there is 1 in 5 students in both communities that is free and reduced lunch, and that roughly the same number of citizens, 1 in 5, are struggling with food insecurity here in our community. So really bringing awareness to that sector of our community, and then also fundraising for our food pantries in both Heber Valley and Park City. Our hope is then to rally a big group of people to hike, build a big appetite over there at Deer Valley, and hopefully the fall and beautiful weather. We anticipate it to be beautiful that day. And then come back down to the base and celebrate our support of those food pantries.
Okay, so one registration fee, and people can just decide how far they're going to walk or bike?
Yes, there are 3 hikes. There's a half-mile hike that goes up to St. Regis, and there's a water and beverage station up there. And then there's a 2-mile hike around the St. Regis, where there's a beautiful set of maples the whole way around. And then you can also hike up to the top of the Silver Lake Express and take the Silver Lake Express down, or hike all the way down and join us back at the snow park base. And then there's always the option, some of my favorite older trails, Village Trail and Pipeline and so forth, are right around that, the old Norba courses. So love riding those. So if people want to bike, they're always welcome to bike too.
Okay. So it kind of all starts from Snow Park Lodge and people take off from that.
Yes.
And then given the different routes, I mean, when do the activities start happening then at the base that they need to be back for?
Right. We'll start everything around 3:00. That's when we'll have the first group go. We'll send the mountain bikers off first, and then we'll send the longer hike off, and then the shorter hikes after that. We anticipate people can roll in anytime between 4 and 5:00 after they've completed their hikes or rides. And then instead of, you know, going to another restaurant to get food or drinks, we'll have everything right there for them. And Deer Valley will be catering through the generosity of Nicholas and Company and Bill White Farms and many of the supporters that we have throughout the year in our food pantry that donate on a regular basis. There will be there donating food to the cause.
Okay, so the ticket, then the cost of admission includes the food and beverages?
Correct. So in that $45, kids are free this year. $45, it covers the hike, t-shirt, food, beer, wine, dessert, and we've gotten it to the sweet spot where it actually now is a fundraiser for us, and so we're able to take those funds and put them back into our food pantry. So we're really excited. That's kind of our sweet spot there.
Okay. Again, registration can all be done online?
We'd prefer everybody do it online. That way you don't have, there's an extra $5 inconvenience fee and you know, the extra staffing costs for day of. But yes, do it online.
Yeah, you may not get a t-shirt either.
That's
or
correct.
At least the size you want.
That's always true.
Okay. Anything else people should know about this?
No, it should be a beautiful fall, so we're really excited. We're hoping those maples will turn just before the hike, and the weather's looking great.
Okay.
There are some amazing kids' activities, climbing wall. There's an art section, face painting. So if you have kids and you're like, well, what do I do with them? Do the short hike, take the funicular down, and then let them climb the wall and everything.
Okay. Hey, Pete, thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much.
Pete Stoughton with the Christian Center. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. It's 8:58.